So, hi, this is Scott Reed for the Campus Comics Cast, which is the podcast for Muddy Monster Comics in Murfreesboro, Illinois. And I am here today talking to Douglas Paskevich. Douglas Paskevich is the owner, creator, writer of Arsenic Lullaby. And then, of course, he also has extensive work in the industry with Mad Magazine, Comedy Central. He's been a variant artist for Valiant, several like Exo Man of War, and was one of the books he had a variant cover for. And then Mercy Sparks, Devils Do. But I guess his big thing and his passion is, of course, the ArsenicLullabies.com website and book. So how are you doing today, Douglas?
Fantastic.
Did I cover everything in that intro? Did I hit enough of the high points?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Good.
I'm a guy who knows a thing or two about comic books.
You do. That is for certain, son. We'll get to some of that because you definitely have some interesting opinions on the industry, which is something that I think people should, you know, hear about. So, but the first question that I always like to ask, being a comic book guy, is do you remember what your first comic book you ever read was, or what your earliest memory related to a comic book is?
I couldn't tell you the first one I ever read, but I remember the first. I got my tonsils out. I don't remember how old I was, maybe 5 or 6. And so back in those days, before all this newfangled technology, that meant you're spending the night in the hospital. back in the day, of course, a night in the hospital now would probably be $250,000. So they would just use a laser, zap the thing out, and you send you on your way. But so anyhow, night in the hospital, some friend of the family dropped off a stack of comic books that he had who knows how long ago. Here you go, kid. Here's a bunch of old crap.
Yeah.
Enjoy your night in the hospital.
Yeah.
And in that was some Marvel supervillain team up and some Avengers. And so there was a storyline with the Avengers and Dr. Doom and the Submariner and the Tama. And I think it was just sheer luck that I got one of the best storylines of that time period in that stack of comic books. And it was also, so it was a great entrance into that because it was well-crafted stories, interesting characters, just a lot of fun, you know, just a shotgun blast of everything that was good about Marvel at the time. Wow. And also, gave me the first experience of the maddening event that is getting sucked into a comic book story, because the final issue of that wrap-up was not in that stack.
Yes, exactly.
And being a six-year-old before the internet, that meant I just had to suffer and wonder what the end was.
Do you remember how long it took you to find the end of that story?
About a year, probably, or longer. until I ran into that friend of the family again and said, hey, do you have the end of that story? And then probably several family events later, the jerk finally showed up with the book. There you go, kid.
At least you're not out of your, you know, preteen years yet before you got to finish it up.
Yeah. Right.
So I guess, you know, this is probably a pretty common question for anybody who has worked in the comic industry, but I guess who do you consider to be the biggest influence on your career?
You mean like illustration wise?
Anyway, illustration, writing, because you do it all, you know. So, I mean, what was the individual that whose work you saw that just kind of said, ooh, I want to do that, or I want to do something like that?
That is a fantastic question.
So I thought I thought I was giving you one over the plate just to knock out of the park here.
yeah, that's an easy one. There's too many. There's no way to just pull out one.
All right.
Because you start as a kid, you know, there's John Buscema and Bob Hall and those early Marvel guys where you're starting to understand how to tell these pictures are telling me a story and they're working together and all that. And then as I got older, then you start running into Jack Davis and Jack Cole, and you get a, you know, these are guys are using more advanced techniques than that. And then, of course, the Jack Kirby's of the world. And, you know, everybody's got a different technique. So what I tried to do as I was learning my craft was take a little bit from everybody. Okay, Jack Cole is really good at moving the eye around a page. Really good. This is how he's doing it. Okay. Jack Kirby is good at making every panel have some sort of impact. Okay, so any Jack Kirby panel you can take and it's visually interesting. So, okay, he's good at that. So there really isn't one guy. I mean, you could ask me a name of a guy and I could tell you what he's good at.
Yeah. Right. Well, I know one of your, like, I've seen from you posted online, it's like, and this was well after you were already, you know, doing some stuff, but like the Barry Windsor Smith Daredevil Black Widow page, that cover from, I don't remember what issue number it is now that I bring it up, but you talk about how you could understand their entire relationship just from that one page, you know?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Yeah, then there's guys that are cover artists. Well, back in the day, they were cover artists who could tell you a whole story, or you could get a feel of the characters, just something about the illustration that they made that just grabbed your imagination and made you feel like you were looking at something happening. You were looking into another world. And then Secret Wars came along and Mike Zeck drew that first issue, that first cover, where it was just a bunch of superheroes charging into combat in some sort of formation that looked really cool. And that was the death knell of the comic book cover. Because since then, it has just been a million variations of, here's all the characters in this book running at you looking cool.
Yeah, how pretty can we make it look, but not tell you anything important about the story?
Exactly. This cover could be used for any issue of the next 5 years that has these characters in it. You're learning nothing whatsoever.
Well, and it's even gotten worse. I know, like, I got in a Daredevil comic book, but it had Jane Foster Thor on the cover, and she doesn't even appear in the book because it's one of those, you know, Thor variant books that they had for Thor month, and you're like, what is this?
Yeah, it doesn't even matter anymore. Here you go. You like Thor, don't you?
Yeah.
That Thor movie is coming out. We got to move units, buddy. So this year issue of Spider-Man has Thor on it, on the cover. That is.
So which of your projects from the past would you say that you're most proud of? And just saying what you're currently working on doesn't count. Isn't fair.
Right. Most proud of is tough to say, but I can say Arsenic Lullaby issue 2. That is one that is like the litmus test for everything I do. As in, I've been chasing that issue my whole career. It's got to be as good or better than that if I can.
Okay, so because most of your stuff that I've read, I've been getting in trade, right? So some of the things that you put together. So what for my benefit, what were some of the stories that were in that second issue? I'm trying to, so I can just kind of wrap my mind around which ones those are. I'm just out of curiosity. That has
the first appearance of Voodoo Joe.
Okay.
And so that story is in there. The cover was visually really strange and well done. And so just those two instances right there, that character is so bizarre and out there, and I'm proud of it. And it's, you know, more or less made my whole career.
Yeah.
And just the ingenuity of it at the time, this is, I don't even know how many years ago anymore, where there was no zombie stuff going on. Voodoo was just this, like, you had Brother Voodoo from Marvel. It was this castaway joke. Nobody's ever going to do anything with this. It's ridiculous. And just so all of that together, the storytelling, and I think was really good and interesting. I did a lot of experimental stuff. And so for those reasons, it's something I always try to chase. The cover past something that's going to grab people's imaginations and make them want to know what the hell is going on. The stories have to be me trying something new, or, and plus it was all really funny.
Okay. So you've obviously you put a lot of time and effort into telling the story through the art, not just through words, right? And it's something that I constantly see you post online about how, you know, this panel, your eyes move a particular way from this panel into this panel so that it focuses in on this element. And it's, you know, I guess you are kind of talking about how it's kind of like a lost art with a lot of comic artists. Is that something you'd want to expound on a little bit more?
Oh, yeah. How much time do you have? 3 hours? 4 hours?
As much time as you want.
It's almost a lost art. There's not a lot of... The understanding of the techniques that are required to make a good, visual, compelling comic book story are kind of falling by the wayside. In a sense that a lot of people, and I hear them say this too, and it makes my skin crawl, even actual pros say, well, yeah, it's like a storyboard. It's like a page of storyboards for a movie. No, it's not, man. Mm-hmm. It's absolutely, to frame your comic book page out like just here's a bunch of storyboards from a movie is to just surrender every technique that makes a comic book what a comic book is. I mean, this is a medium that has advantages beyond a novel, advantages beyond a movie, advantages beyond a cartoon, because you're seeing everything at once. You're seeing several images at once. So the timing is always going to be strange, and you can use that to your advantage. You know, you can make all these images work together or butt up against each other. It seems like it's a disadvantage that people can see everything at once. And it can be unless you know what you're doing. You know, like you can say, well, they're always going to see the punchline first. Well, not really. You can hide that punchline. You can give that punchline more impact because you can manipulate the timing. And you can manipulate the timing even a way that you can't do with stand-up comedy, you know, which I've done a share of that over the years. And well, it is maddening that the timing is in the hands of the reader, you know, but if you learn how to manipulate that, you can tell jokes in a way that you can't really tell in any other medium. If I'm making sense, are you following me so far?
I am. Yeah.
Yeah. So if you got six panels on a page, you want those panels to work together. Like the reader reads left from left to right. So you visually want to keep his eye going left to right, unless you want to break that rhythm for some particular reason.
Yeah, you see a lot of comic books where they have to like put in arrows to force the reader to go a certain way. That just seems like it's not natural any longer whenever you do that.
Right. Using that arrow means you've done something wrong or you've drawn yourself into a hole. And more importantly than that, you're breaking the reality of the story you're telling. You know, once that eye has to see a symbolic, like arrow, mm-hmm. or like a literal arrow.
Yeah.
I should say that their brain is now coming out of the story to understand where its eyes are supposed to go next, as opposed to you have somebody being punched into the panel onto the right and then being shoved down to the panel on the next tier on the left or what have you. I mean, there's a whole lot of ways you can lead that eye around. And so you keep that person's imagination in that book and the eyes are effortlessly being moved around and they don't even really consciously make any other effort than they just would reading any other story in a novel, let's say.
Okay. I don't know if this even ties into anything that you're talking about, but I remember reading early stories like where, I guess it was Kirby and Simon, where, you know, after producing enough comic books, they finally realized, oh, you know, we can do this giant 2-page splash in the middle of books because, you know, we know that that's where the staple's going to be. So we can actually do a larger image. So whenever the reader turns that page, you can just kind of blow something up at them right there because that's, you know, you're going to have lots of art just right there sitting in the middle of that book. So
right. Well, and then those big splash pages like that, this is another kind of lost art is lettering something and where you put the word balloons. Because if you have a big splash page like that, you can use that those word balloons to move the reader around. So if there's something in that splash page that you want to be obvious, like say the ultimate nullifier, right? You don't have to stick that right smack dab in the middle of that composition. You can, but that's going to be visually not that interesting. And if you put it on the left in the middle of all this Kirby crackle and weird scientific technology, no one's going to notice it.
Mm-hmm.
Right. But if there's word balloons on there slowly leading to that ultimate nullifier, well, then there you go. You have this huge, beautiful splash with Kirby crackle and alien technology and the important thing of Reed Richards flicking the ultimate nullifier. Mm-hmm. That can be nice and small and hidden in some corner somewhere, and you just get those word balloons lead the eye right to it.
And I think you talked about, and I may have been that Casper cartoon that you did, where even like the, and I maybe I'm mixing this up with a different one, but like the flooring, the wood flooring, where the lines of the flooring are even pointing into the next panel or where you want the reader's eyes to kind of like follow. So,
right. Yeah. I mean, you can do it obviously with having Casper flying to the right mm-hmm. or something like that. But what I like to do a lot of times is just use the background to lead the reader's eye. You know, where you put the vanishing point is mm-hmm. going to lead the reader's eye, or texture on the floor. If the wood grain is all moving to the right, that's a pretty nice visual cue for the eye. You know, what the eye is looking at, you think of that as like water. Water is going to find the lowest level. Mm-hmm. So you don't have to put a great big obvious visual cue. You can just make it subtle and the eye is just going to naturally find that flow.
Yeah, it's just something that you obviously think about a lot and spend a lot of time considering whenever you're doing, because I see, you know, you post those pictures of the stacks of your practice stuff and I'm like, wow. It's like, how many times before you feel like you have it right? You know, it's just it's incredible. So
doing the layouts, that's the most important part of the whole thing, laying out a page properly, because that's where you capture someone's imagination or you don't.
Mm-hmm.
Because there's plenty of people out there who can draw a, say, 69 Buick better than I can.
Oh, yeah.
Right? So if a page is a car crash, they can draw some beautiful 69 Buick that's detailed and refined and precise more so than I can, but they can't draw that car crash better than me. Because I'm grabbing the reader's eye, I'm building up timing and then impact and using different kinds of panels. So they feel like they're watching a car crash happen, as opposed to they're looking at a really beautiful picture of a car crash. That there's a really important difference there, because what we're trying to do is capture people's imagination. And what I see a lot of now is, that's a really beautiful picture of a car crash. But nobody who's looking at that is thinking other than that is a beautifully illustrated car crash.
Well, and I wouldn't say that they were drawing it better than you anyway. They'd be drawing it different than you.
Sure. Yes. Nice catch on that, Scott. Yes, obviously not better. Different. More realistic, perhaps, with less style and panache than,
that's
say,
right,
a Douglas Paskevich. But they gave it a good shot.
Now, each holiday season on arsenicwallabies.com, you open up what you call the Christmas bunker.
Yeah.
And I don't know how many, but I know you've been doing it for several years. I don't know how many years exactly that you have been doing that, but I was just wondering if you could talk a little bit about the history of the Christmas bunker and why you did it, what the motivation is behind it.
Yeah, it's been many years now. I don't know. 7 or more, maybe 10. It's all a blur. All a blur. I drew Arsenic Lullaby number 2. No, I drew Arsenic Lullaby number 1. I didn't think it was going to work out. And so I drew number 2, which had a zombie fetus on the cover, because what the hell? And then number 1 sold really good. And I said, oh, no. Number 2 has a zombie fetus on it. I just jacked up my whole career. And the next thing I knew, I was talking to you on this, this podcast.
This is a blur, huh?
Right. Everything else is a blur. So the Christmas bunker was sort of, in a sense, I thought it'd be a fun contrast since Arsenic Lullaby is really dark and edgy and strange. I thought that'd be a nice contrast, jamming some sort of Arsenic Lullaby event into the Christmas holiday. And also, that's a tough time of year for a lot of people. For some people, it's joyous and fun, and that's great. And I love Christmas. Christmas does not love me.
Gosh, okay.
and that's the same for a lot of people. So I also thought it'd be good, and it sort of evolved into, hey, this is a website we can all go to and hang out and just have something going on that's different, and it's not cheery and over the top, joyous and all this. It's where we can all go and just read dark, despicable stuff happening and just chill out. just decompress. Just hide from everything else that's going on that, for whatever reason, we're not really able to participate in on the emotional level of other people.
All right, fair enough.
If that makes sense.
That does. So, yeah, and speaking of the website, you know, I kind of wonder how you're making any money off of Arsenic Lullabies, because it feel like you have like every single one of your cartoons and comic strips and art. It's like it's all there. it's almost all there.
it seems that way. Okay. Doesn't it?
Yeah.
But there's over 1,000 pages of Arsenic Lullaby.
Okay.
So there is plenty out there to be culled. I don't know. I'm drawing a blank, Scott.
Well, that's okay. It's one of those things where, since I've been mainly reading it in like the trades that the digest that you put together, it's like I'm wondering how much stuff I don't have of yours. You know, I feel like I've got probably a good percentage of it, but I just wonder if there's things out there that I don't have because it hasn't been reprinted yet in one of those, you know, trades or whatever, you know, that you sell at conventions and such.
Right. Well, and ultimately, anybody can take something and put it up on the internet. Like somebody could scan in every issue and put it up there. There isn't a whole lot you can do to combat that. But really, there's a difference between reading something online and holding it in your hand. So, what's the word I'm looking for? See, the way I'm moving units, Scott. Here's how I'm moving units is by moving units. Uh-huh. You can have that digital one or two pages here and there, but you're not getting the full story. You're not seeing the issue altogether. And so there's a little bit of you are missing out.
Oh yeah, well you're definitely missing out, you know. And that's why I'm buying them, is I like sharing them with other people, you know. It's here's something that you should read. You find the right person who's got the right sensibility. This is something that you should read. And most people I've handed it to have not been disappointed.
That's good. Excellent. Well done. Well done, my friend. Well, and the other thing is, you know, I come from a stand-up comedy background. So each issue is laid out almost like a 1-hour special. Right? The stories are set up, you know, even though it's a 6-page story that has nothing to do with this 5-page story, which has nothing to do with this 3-page story, they are put in a specific order to give the next story a little bit more punch, or to get the reader's mind in a different mindset so they don't see the punchline of this next one coming. So every story in there is working together, and the order in which they're put in are working together. So you, like, say you could watch 18 minutes of Chris Rock or Bill Burr, but if it's from different routines and different points of their career, you're not getting, it's not, you're not getting the same product. You're not getting as much punch as if you just watch 18 full minutes of Bill Burr's stand-up, boom, 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 boom. You know, you're not seeing something build up and lead into something else.
So are you with like, I guess, COVID restrictions finally apparently starting to ease? Are you going to get back into the swing of things with conventions? Do you have plans of anything coming up in the near future?
That's something I haven't quite made my mind up on yet. Yeah.
Well, I won't force you to make a decision on that.
Well, here's the thing. I don't know that I'm. Well, okay, we're just two buddies talking, right, Scott?
Ignore that button that says that we're recording.
I said, you know, my life really got flipped sideways, right? So for a lot of people, hey, everything's opening up again. And I'm like, no, man, it's going to be 3 years before my life has any resemblance to what it was when this started. So I don't know if it's a great idea for me to be in a building with a bunch of people smiling at me going, hey, it's all over.
Yeah, no.
Excuse me? Oh, it's all over, is it? Nothing in my life, personal, career, nothing resembles anything. I'm still getting my head around all this.
Okay.
So there's that. You know, you got to be personable with people.
Mm-hmm.
And that's tough for me on an average year. I'm a bit of a curmudgeon.
Well, I always, you know, I always quote W.C. Fields, right? It's like, I'm without prejudice. I hate all people equally. So.
Right. So, but going an entire year without going to a convention and then going to a convention where I'm going to be talking to thousands of people a day.
Woo, too much all at once.
That's going to be a lot. So I think I need to ease into it a little bit. And there don't seem like a lot of conventions don't seem like they're really all that confident in what they're doing, which I understand completely. But I don't know that I want to be a guinea pig for that. I know at some point, okay, we're all on Normandy Beach getting shelled. At some point, we all got to get out and just charge forward. And I'm with you on that.
But you don't want to be first.
I'm right behind you. I'm right behind you all the way on this one.
All right. So what do you have? What projects then? Are you got any projects that you're working on that you can talk about?
I've got several I'm working on that I can't really talk about.
Oh,
unfortunately. Because, well, this is the problem. As your career advances, you start getting into things that have non-disclosure contracts.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I've been saying for a while now, this job was a lot more fun before I got good at it.
Yeah,
because now that I'm good at it, laying out a page doesn't take 20 minutes. Laying out a page takes 8 hours. And inking a page doesn't take 3 hours. Inking a page takes an entire day. Oh. So it's a lot more time consuming. And there's projects, if I'm doing it for myself, I can just show everybody and talk about and shoot my mouth off. That's when I'm starting my career. Now that my career is at the point where I'm being hired for things and I'm working on things that are larger and bigger and more exciting, there's now a contract that I've signed that where I have to keep my mouth shut. You know, like that Comedy Central, I knew that was coming for about a year and a half, 2 years, that I had to just sit there and dummy up and act like there was nothing going on. And I'm just spinning my wheels. I don't got nothing going on. Meanwhile, I know Comedy Central is making a cartoon out of one of my things. I just have to stand there like, yeah. When you're putting out something new, you know, I got something going.
Maybe. Sometimes.
And then finally, when it's going to air, there. Are you happy? There. See? That's what I was working on. A cartoon on TV. Are you happy? Get off my ass. I'm not just sitting here with my finger up my nose. But. I am working on a story for a Greek magazine that's a lot of fun, which is about a guy who hunts monsters, which on the surface, that sounds like something you've seen a million times. However, it's not. And I don't know how to explain it.
Or are we going to get an English translation is not. What I want to know, because I don't read Greek. So,
you're going to have to learn Greek, my friend. It's not that hard. There's only 26. Yeah, they've got a couple 26 letters. We've got, what, 27? I don't know. And the next issue of Arsenic Lullaby, I'm muddling through. And I've been doing a lot of NFT art. And yeah.
Well, you mentioned it first. So you want to talk about the NFT stuff a little bit, since you brought it up, not me.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know how to explain it if somebody doesn't know what it is.
But you've had some success with it, though, right?
Yeah, yeah. You know, everybody found ways to keep themselves busy during these troubling times. And so I learned about cryptocurrency technology.
Well, you were into crypto prior to, because I know, like, from things like Steemit and stuff like that you've kind of been paying attention to that for a little while. So,
right. Like, I hate Facebook. I think it's awful, but it's a necessary evil.
Exactly.
But that being said, you know, I'm always keeping my eye out for what is going to supersede this, because we all loved MySpace and it disappeared, unfortunately. So I've always got my eyes on the horizon of, okay, what's going to supersede this? What's going to be the next thing? And there's a lot of social media websites that operate on sort of a cryptocurrency technology. Mm-hmm. So that's how I got into that. And then this technology that runs cryptocurrency, how can I put this into layman's terms as quickly as possible? Basically, you've got several hundred computers that are verifying and witnessing a transaction.
Yeah, through the blockchain.
Right. Yep. Through the blockchain, they're all independently verifying that this thing happened, this transaction happened. Somewhere along the line, people figured out, hey, this transaction doesn't have to just be currency. This transaction can be, I have uploaded this file, this digital file of artwork can now be witnessed by all these things. So this digital artwork attached to this technology is now a transferable, ownable thing. You know, even though it doesn't exist tangibly, right, it's still able to be transferred to people, just like if you use a credit card for something. All these computers understand that these zeros and ones are being transferred. This computer understands that this, say, Arsenic Lullaby cover exists, and the ownership of it can be transferred to X, Y, and Z. And it all sounds sort of sci-fi and surreal and like, oh, well, why couldn't I just copy the file?
Right.
Well, you could, yeah.
But yeah, you would own the file. You would just be copying the file.
Right.
So just a way to verify ownership.
Exactly. So this is, you know, if you could copy a Willie Mays rookie card, or you could get a very nice reprint of such a thing. But certain people enjoy ownership. You know, there's a collector's mentality. So this is a collector's mentality for somebody who likes or enjoys artwork. Mm-hmm. And as time marches on, less and less artwork is actually tangible.
Mm-hmm.
Like a lot of these comic book covers, they don't exist at all in the tangible world. Okay. If you want to buy the latest, you want to own the latest cover of Captain America, it only exists digitally.
Mm-hmm.
Not one pencil was put to paper. Not one drop of ink was put to paper. Not one brush full of watercolor red was put to paper. It was created completely digitally. And someone can now say, I own that, and it's verifiable and provable. So that's trying to make a long story not so long. And so that's what an NFT is. That's called an NFT, non-fungible token.
All right. Well, that would be a good segue into, unless you had some more you wanted to say about that, into talk, because your process is not digital, right? I mean, you work almost entirely, I mean, well, with the exception of the things you've created digitally for NFT, but you even start with those with pencil and brush to paper, right, before they get converted over. So
yes. Yeah. Even with the NFTs, the foundation is traditional art. And so if they're animated, they're animated traditionally, like a old animation cell. I've redrawn that finger 7 times so that the finger moves, for example.
Or the head bobs. Or the
head bobs or the fire crackles or whatever. Yeah. So yeah, comic books, as I do them, as I illustrate them, it's all old school. It's pencil onto bristle board. I ink everything with a brush. It's time consuming, but there's a certain look and charm to it that I have not seen duplicated without those traditional tools.
Yeah, and anybody who's listening to this absolutely needs to go to your website and watch some of your videos where you just video yourself inking pages. It's just, it's amazing. So
it's tedious.
Well, I guess it is for you, but for those of us who watch it periodically, you know, it's just like it, because I can't even draw a circle well, you know, so it's with a protractor, you know, I find a way to mess it up. And so seeing somebody who's very, very skilled at it, and you know, it's like, you know, I can enjoy watching people play tennis, but I can't play tennis to save my life, you know. It's just crazy. So it's just a lot of fun to watch somebody who knows what they're doing, you know, work on their craft. So
yeah, I hope so. I hope it's interesting and more fun for the people watching than me doing it. Although it's fun when it's done and I look at it. I mean, I ran into a couple of things. I was looking for a page the other day and ran across some old stuff that I had inked and said, oh, wow, that looks really good.
Yeah.
How about that? Did I do that? Wow, I did that. I don't know if I could ever do that again.
Well, it's like you got your sci-fi scene that you just created that you weren't able to use, that you've got tucked away in the archives for the future, right?
Yeah, exactly. I spent a good 4 hours drawing the surface of a moon with craters and all. And then turns out I'm not going to need that scene for a particular project.
Oh,
you know, I can tell you this, all you young people out there. Make sure everything has been ironed out as much as possible. I mean, these things are going to happen. Things are going to get cut and changed and whatever. But just do your best to make sure that this is as ironed out as possible before you start drawing the thing, because it is heartbreaking.
All right. Well, if somebody wants to track you down and you know, become more familiar with your work, and most time that would be online, what would it be the best way for people to do that?
Well, I am everywhere, Scott. Everywhere on seeing all. If you go to arseniclullaby.com, that's my home base, and that'll get you started. There's plenty of samples on there and whatnot. And from there, there's links to pretty much everywhere else. Twitter, Facebook, Hive, and Steemit. You know, if you're looking to branch out into the social media, that's going to be newer. Mm-hmm. There's even Gab and Minds, which I think are just full of political arguments right now. That's basically the only people who are there are to argue about political things. Okay. But the technology is new and it's free speech. So that's a place I like to be on. Somewhere I'm not going to get censored is right. Primarily where I want to go.
Okay.
But anyhow, make a long story short, go to arsenicwallaby.com and there's links to wherever you like to be and absorbing things.
Excellent. So, all right. Well, thank you very much for taking the time to talk to us and good luck.
Hey, in the words of the immortal Steve Dahl, I don't need luck. I have talent.
Okay.
Thanks for having me on, Scott.
No, thank you. So have a good one.
You as well.